This episode details the subject of rape and other acts of violence. Please exercise caution when listening.
25-year-old Cherie Warren of Roy disappeared 9 days ago.
Hello?
I get this phone call. And this man says, "Hi, I'm doing a survey on ladies' lingerie and women's apparel. Can you help me out here?" All of a sudden I realize, this sounds like Carrie Hartman.
Phone records showed that he had made literally thousands of those types of calls. Probably a guy that's perverted.
He looked for homes that were open during the early morning hours. If a female was alone inside the house, he sexually assaulted her.
There are a lot of missing girls.
When Cherie Warren disappeared, investigators believe foul play was involved.
Her ex-husband was a suspect.
But she's dating Carrie Hartman. That was the last anyone has ever seen her.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Raw Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And...
Hello, I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime. And not only these real criminal minds who solve these crimes, but dogged, determined journalists who do not let go when they're pursuing a cold case. And with us today is...
Dave Cawley from KSL Podcasts. That is one heck of an intro, so thank you very much. I am the host of a podcast called Cold. It is a narrative podcast that focuses on unsolved cold cases. We have three seasons so far, and I'm assuming we will get into all of that as we go forward here.
Sure.
Welcome.
Dave, can you just tell us what journalistic experience you have? Where are you from? What do you do?
Absolutely. So I am based in Salt Lake City, Utah. I began in radio journalism in 2003. I worked as a field reporter covering everything from crime, courts, politics, news of the day, moved into news production. So I was in charge of a four-hour daily afternoon newswheel show on the biggest news talk in Utah, KSL News Radio. I did that for about 5 years. And then in 2018, one of the cases that I had covered through my radio journalism career became sort of a passion of mine. I was researching, reinvestigating this case, and through conversation with my news director, we came up with the idea of really expanding out our coverage and doing that in the form of the podcast. So since 2018, I have been 100% dedicated to coverage of cold cases through the Cold Podcast.
Awesome.
So Susan Powell was your first case. And I remember, Dave, I was contacted by so many people to ask, had I listened to it? And I really should. It had a huge impact. So can you just nutshell the case for people that don't know? And we can talk a little bit about the detail of 1, 2, and 3, because for our listeners, we really recommend that you listen to all three seasons. And I, Dave, have had you in my ears, certainly for the last 24 hours. And wow, your work is incredible. The detail that you bring, which is so important in these cases, and honoring the victims and centering them. And I just want to thank you for that before we dive into each of the cases, because at Real Crime Profile, that's something that really chimes with us. And we're so happy to do a crossover with you.
And Laura, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Listening to your show as well, knowing that you're always talking about the victimology and making sure that you're highlighting who these people are, we're not just telling, sometimes difficult stories for the sake of looking at that kind of, car crash on the side of the road aspect. We are hoping to bring some justice to the people at the center of these stories. It means a lot to me, and I can tell it means a lot to all of you as well. Disappearance of Susan Powell began in December of 2009. Her husband, Josh Powell, and two children, Charlie and Braden, failed to show up one snowy Monday morning for work and for daycare. And a daycare provider became concerned because this was out of the usual, went to the family home in West Valley City, Utah. It's a suburb of Salt Lake. Discovered nobody seemed to be home. There was fresh snow on the driveway, no tire tracks. And so the daycare provider contacted a family emergency contact, which was Josh Powell, the husband's mom and sister. So they came to the house. Forced entry, along with West Valley City Police, discovered nobody was in the house. The family's vehicle was missing. That afternoon, Josh Powell and the two boys return home, and they tell the waiting detective that they had been out in an area of Utah called the West Desert, which is very remote, no cell service, you know, dirt roads, nobody around for 50 or 100 miles, and that they had made an impromptu decision the night before to go camping in this snowstorm. No idea where Susan was or why she hadn't shown up for work. That case, over the course of about the next 2 years, took a lot of different directions, but primarily what you need to know is Josh Powell relocated from Utah. He moved back to Washington State, where he was from, moved in with his father, took the children with him, wouldn't cooperate with law enforcement. As a reporter covering this case at the time, it was very frustrating. Police weren't talking to us about what was going on. We didn't know it, but their entire case was under a gag order, a court seal. And then all of a sudden, in about August of 2011, stuff starts happening. The police are doing searches out in the desert of abandoned mines. They are serving a search warrant at the house where Josh Powell is staying with his dad in Washington State. And as part of that, they discover voyeur videos and images that Josh Powell's father had been making of women all around the Tacoma, Washington area, but most importantly, of some underage neighbor girls who he had filmed surreptitiously through the bathroom window of the house next door. This resulted in criminal charges against Steve Powell, the father-in-law, and the seizure of the two children, Charlie and Braden, into Washington State's child protective custody. Now, Josh Powell was very clearly a suspect in the disappearance of Susan, but police hadn't been able to find her body. And as a result of that, a very contentious court battle developed between Josh Powell and the state of Washington as he was trying to regain custody of his children. A judge in Washington State allowed him to have supervised visitation. And then on Super Bowl Sunday in 2012, as the visitation supervisor brought the children over to a house that Josh Powell had rented, he slammed the door in her face, had the children inside, and very violently took their lives and his own.
Oh, God.
That essentially resulted in basically the unwinding of the police investigation because, in short order, Josh Powell's brother, who was believed to perhaps be a co-conspirator in Susan Powell's disappearance, also took his own life, and the West Valley City Police Department ran out of leads. So that was about the place where I, as a journalist, picked up the copies of the case file that were made public and started looking for any information that hadn't been public before, storylines that hadn't been shared, witnesses we hadn't talked to, and that really was kind of the inception of what became season one of the Cold Podcast.
A horrible story. Oh my God.
It is a horrible story.
Yes. And I mean, often with these cases, people think about what violence looks like and they think about physical signs of abuse. Were there broken bones? Were there bruises? When they think about, you know, Susan Powell and the life that she was living, and you see all these lovely smiley photos of the family. But what we don't know from a photo is what level of control might be going on, not just even behind closed doors. Actually, often coercive control is in every aspect of people's life. It's just that people don't see it as controlling behavior, and the children are affected too. We often don't think about children who are in homes where there's a coercive controller, or that coercive controllers can be very charming and very plausible, and they can be manipulative. So these are sort of, when I was listening to Susan Powell's case and really thinking about, well, what's truly going on in the family dynamics, often those signs get missed. But I can say 100% that a father, if they're a good father, they do not kill their children on any form of contact. And oftentimes we heard it with the Haight case, and you're in Utah. We heard exactly the same of what happened in that case with Tarsha Haight, that a eulogy was written about a good father who had shot his five children and his wife, who had filed for divorce, and her mother, who was there to offer support and protection. But too often, Dave, I hear, you know, well, he was still a good father. And well, he may have done something to the mother, but he's still a good father. The question for me is about coercive control of the dynamics that were happening, but also why was he given any form of contact with the children when he was under investigation? And sometimes in these cases, people just see that they're still a good enough father. Well, and they don't how can that be?
Yeah, right. Because as you say, Laura, doing something bad to the mother is being a bad father. In other words, this is their mother. This is the children's mother. So hurting her in some way obviously means that he's not a good father. But anyway, that is a very cautionary tale. It's a horrible case, but not the only one you talk about in your series, Cold.
No. So we came out of season one of Cold looking at the Susan Powell case. And as you say, all of those elements of coercive control, Josh Powell, the husband in that case, he knew how to toe the line and not leave bruises, but he was doing all the kinds of things you talk about on your show, right? He was controlling the finances. He was limiting Susan's access to friends and family. Very kind of classic narcissistic abusive traits, even though they don't rise to the level of physical abuse until Susan disappears and is presumably murdered. When we shifted focus for our second season, it was quite a lot different. We stepped back in time and looked at a case from 1985. And this is the disappearance, unsolved in the sense that we don't know where this woman's remains are, of Joyce Yost. Joyce Yost, in a nutshell, she was followed home from a club one evening in April of 1985 by a man she had never met. As she pulled into her carport outside her apartment, he confronted her, blocked her car with his vehicle, showed up and stuck his knee in the door of her car and told her he wanted to take her for a drink. Joyce was very clearly uncomfortable with this, told the man she didn't want, to spend time with him, but tried to put him off politely, recognizing this was a dangerous situation. That man forced himself on her there. He ended up actually abducting Joyce, taking her to his house, holding her for several hours, sexually assaulting her, threatening her that if she told anybody what happened, that he would come back and kill her. Joyce, against her better judgment, after she managed to convince this man to release her, did report the assault to law enforcement. And kind of the cornerstone of Cold Season 2 was a never-before-heard tape of her really telling this story in her own words. What we know is that in the months that followed, she went to court, she testified at a preliminary hearing, but then 10 days before she was to testify at trial, she disappeared. As the season winds on, we find out that the man who assaulted her came back and very grimly plotted to try to have hitmen kill Joyce. And then when that fell through, he ended up taking her life himself. And that man, Doug Lovell, is today on death row in the state of Utah. But over the course of the last, several decades, has continually basically fought to avoid A, telling where Joyce's remains are and giving that closure to her family, and B, trying to forestall his execution.
And Joyce's story really has a big impact in season three that we're going to get to. But that thing about a woman coming forward and telling, having the guts and the bravery to tell law enforcement what happened to her, and then for her to be murdered for it, had just a cascading effect on so many other women in this area. It's just horrible.
Yeah, I agree. For a woman to come forward and for the justice system to leave her hanging like that, whether it's a domestic violence situation in the home or whether it comes from outside, to not appreciate the danger that that woman is in, to not protect her, the justice system has failed completely in this case.
And I totally agree with you. I think what we see when we go back and look at the record is there was an untold story here about how Doug Lovell, the man that killed Joyce Yost, was repeatedly allowed to slip out of custody, slip out of jail. In one instance, he was actually caught driving DUI with a loaded firearm in the vehicle. He's a felon. He's not allowed to possess a gun, let alone be driving drunk toward this woman's house. And he's booked into jail and then kicked out the next morning back onto the street. High danger level. And then at the same time, we see Joyce, who has been subjected to this random violent act, and she's just trying to put her life back together, to move on, to not let this define her. And so when she has people who are telling her, hey, why don't you come stay with us for a little while? Why don't you, take some time off work? That's not where she wants to be. And so, it's this balancing act of trying to respect that she has her autonomy, that she may not even realize the danger that she's in because she's going through a trauma response, right? And the failure of the criminal justice system to recognize the dangerousness of that situation and protect her is a major, major theme of Cold Season 2.
And the dangerousness of him. You know, yes. I track these serial, dangerous, violent men and have done across my 27 years. And just what you described, Dave, this constant slap on the wrist and being enabled and greenlit, the message to him is carry on. The message to her is you have to change your whole life. You're the one that has to, you know, move or disappear yourself. What about him? Why wasn't anyone looking in terms of proactive problem solving for him? And too often we think about the victim and what she should do. But what I always ask law enforcement to do is to think about the perpetrator and their history. And most of them have these protracted histories. And the messaging is all wrong. It really is. And I think, you know, as you describe it, the fact that he appeared and he put his knee in the door and he's pushing the boundary, you know, women have these experiences every day. I'm not saying somebody putting the foot in the door, but being followed or being given a look or made to feel unsafe. And I have to say, you know, the last couple of weeks, I've just dealt with so many horrific cases. And it really is getting to a point where male violence is soaring. And women are only as safe as their male partner allows them to be, or the men on the street allow them to be. And I think people forget this because oftentimes we're so busy saying, well, she should have done X, Y, or Z, rather than, well, what about the men who do this? Why aren't we, all of us collectively, all women, all men, and it needs men too, standing up and ensuring, particularly in the criminal justice system, we're doing something about these men.
Yeah, well, at least you have two of those men here on this podcast with you. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are many millions others out there, but maybe they just don't know and they don't realize how they need to step up. They need to be there and they need to be observant and situationally aware and make sure that they're not even tacitly encouraging their other friends or their coworkers or their buddies to engage in this kind of behavior that really puts women at risk.
No, what about the criminal justice agencies, though, Jim? I'm talking about these men, majority of the time, you know this, have protracted histories. You know, we've come on to season three. None of this stuff surprises me anymore. You know, we know that sex offenders and men who are devious and who have power and control issues, it starts early on in life. And we can't trust what they tell us, but we should be listening to what women say. And we should when they come forward. You know, I really have had enough of these campaigns where we say, come forward, report what's happened to you. But then ultimately, nothing happens and women aren't protected, nor can they be protected when the very system set up to protect them turn a blind eye or are so busy focused on, oh, well, all these victims, they tend to not want to go forward with the criminal prosecution. Yeah, right, because they are so fearful that they feel that they have to manage it on their own. And Joyce's case, you know, most people would think something like that would never happen. But it does. And that's why it was important for you to tell her story. It does and it can. And we have to put the lens and the focus on the problem.
Exactly.
And I do think, Jim, it is about, you know, and it's fantastic you and Dave doing this work, but it is about it takes everybody, every person to be accountable because misogyny thrives in this current ecosystem where these things are just accepted, where there's sexism and misogynistic things that are said or done to women, or women, we can't walk down the street without being leered at or commented at and constantly sexually objectified. You know, it's an everyday thing. You speak to most women and they'll tell you about their encounters where some guy came onto them in a bar and it was unwanted or they were followed down the street. I've been hearing it constantly these last couple of weeks again, and I just feel we talk about cold cases, but the same themes just come up over and over again. And Dave, you're spotlighting it all, which is so important as we do, but it does take everybody.
I
It really struck me, Dave. You start, we're going to turn to season three now, and you start season three with something that I'd almost forgotten about. And that is the good old obscene phone call, which, you know, we don't really get that much anymore because a lot of us don't have landlines and we have our cell phones and we get trolled in other ways now. We get obscenities in other ways. But I remember being, you know, a college student and my landline ringing and you pick it up and there's somebody on the phone and it's all about trying to terrorize me. It's not about sex. It's trying to say something obscene, you know, let me hear that they're masturbating or whatever it is, or even trying to sort of fool me at first. Like it's like, maybe they're pretending like they're somebody I know at first. And then they say something disgusting. And it's so funny how I'd forgotten
the heavy breathing, Lisa.
The heavy breathing. Yes. All of that. And I'd forgotten all that, but you start off season three with that. And we're going to turn to that. Season three, by the way, is ostensibly about the disappearance of Sheree Warren and the persons of interest in her case. But my goodness, Dave, you draw this huge picture of Ogden, Utah, which you might not think is a hotbed of crime, but you've got multiple serial rapists, serial killers. You got a sex club that is like extorting each other in ways that like Jeffrey Epstein would be like, wow, these people are hardcore. I mean, you draw this picture that is so incredibly rich in, sadly, in season three. Do you want to tell us how you got to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So coming out of, you know, Ogden, Utah in 1985 with the Joyce Yost case, as I was making, you know, connections, source relationships with people talking about that case, I started hearing this name Sheree Warren a lot. And there were some crossovers. You know, Sheree disappeared within just a couple of months of when Joyce disappeared. Both of them, no body situations. Neither has ever been recovered. And so there was even some question about, you know, did a suspect in one possibly have involvement in the other case? And that's kind of where I started, was trying to tear this apart. You know, Sheree Warren, I'll tell you a little bit about her. She was a young mother, 25 years old. She grew up in a suburb of Ogden, just next to Hill Air Force Base called Roy. She was sharp. She wasn't, as far as I know, her super social. She, you know, what didn't have a lot of extracurricular activities, but she had a great family, great mom and dad, hardworking people. She was a pretty good student, and she came out of high school, married a man named Charles Warren, and then very quickly, I think, learned that this marriage wasn't what it should have been. Charles Warren had been married before. He was about 10 years older than Sheree, and he already had a son of his own. They quickly had a child of their own, and Sheree kind of found herself trapped in this relationship that she ultimately didn't want to be in. So in the early months of 1985, she had filed for divorce and moved out from the house where she was living with her husband, ended up back with her parents, and was really kind of trying to work to support herself and take care of her three-year-old son. She got a promotion at her job. That promotion meant that she was going to be having to commute about 30 miles each way to an office for a credit union in Salt Lake City, Utah. So she had just started that new position and by all indications was very excited about it, was excited about life, had, you know, been seeing people, men while she was separated. So had, you know, some good prospects as far as what her future was going to be. And then she leaves the night of October 2nd, 1985 from work, tells a man that she'd been training at this, you know, credit union that she was going to her car. She was going to go meet up with her ex-husband to do a custody exchange. And then she never is seen after that.
A custody exchange, or was it she was picking him up for his car, or?
Kind of both. So okay. The situation, the estranged husband, Charles Warren, he is a car nut, and his whole deal is buying and selling cars, and he loves Toyota Supras. So he's got this Toyota Supra, and the story is that in the morning when she handed her son off to her estranged husband before going to work, he said, "Can you come pick me up at this car dealership when you get off and give me a ride back home?" She agrees to do that. So ostensibly, that's where she's headed when she leaves her office. Now, the estranged husband tells police he can't remember why, but he decided to call that meeting off. He stayed home and he just figured that Sheree would come, you know, get her son later that evening. The police are not really able to get very far with the estranged husband. He very quickly invokes his right to remain silent and tells them that if they want to talk to him, they're going to have to talk to a lawyer. So it has all these hallmarks on the face of being, you know, romantic
questionable
partner, past partner. Yeah, absolutely, Jim. Very questionable.
I just have a question about, you know, when Cherie wanted to leave the marriage, was there any indication of domestic violence or abuse that initiated that?
We don't know very well for her. What I can tell you is that there's a story that develops after she files for divorce, where the divorce is kind of taking some time, dragging out. They're at odds over child support. And the story is that the estranged husband shows up at her workplace with a coat and a handgun tucked in his waistband and makes comments to the effect of, you know, that there are all kinds of ways to get even with people. We also learned through the investigation that the estranged husband, when he split from his first wife, credibly was accused of beating her with a tire iron, luring her to a place where, you know, it wouldn't be observed. And when she showed up to, you know, supposedly help him with car trouble, again, another kind of theme here, that he physically assaulted her and left her basically for dead. It's kind of miraculous she survived.
Well, These are things that, you know, Laura and I focus on behavior, and behavior speaks volumes, even if the person doesn't say a damn word. And so obviously in this case, you'd be looking for somebody with motive and opportunity and means, and Chuck seems to have all of those, right?
He does.
He seems like a viable suspect. We try though to stay away from looking at the suspects and evaluating them until we've sort of gone into the victimology completely. But in this case, obviously, the way it works out is the two people who are closest to her that are intimately involved in her victimology are the two suspects. So we need to sort of cross over anyway. But as far as Chuck is concerned, as far as Charles Warren is concerned, obviously he has some veiled threats to the victim. He has a scheduled meeting with her, which he says he didn't go to, but she says she was on her way to. But then we also have a dichotomy brewing where two women say they saw Cherie at her boyfriend's house that night. So did she go to the car shop and not find her ex-husband there and then go to Carrie's house?
Yeah.
Or did she just not tell her coworker that the plans had changed? Those are things we don't know.
And right? Nobody saw her go to the car dealership,
exactly.
Right? Nobody, she wasn't seen there. The last person to see her was the person she was training, correct, at her work?
That's right. As far as we know, now I will say the record in this case is a little thin for some of that. I think, you know, back in the 80s, especially in, you know, smaller suburbs, record keeping wasn't great. So we don't have a lot of details about who was contacted at the dealership or what. But Jim, you mentioned a name there. Let me introduce Real Crime Profile listeners to a man named Carrie Hartman. Carrie Hartman was I don't even know how to describe him in a word. He was a Vietnam veteran. So in the early 70s, and where the story starts in Cold Season 3 is this phone call that we heard Lisa allude to.
Describe, yeah.
Which is he would make calls pretending to be a representative from a magazine or a fashion company and say he wanted to ask women about their lingerie. And if he could keep the listener, the person he called, on the line long enough, he would turn those questions sexual. So as we move the story forward, we learn that Carrie Hartman was dating Cherie Warren while she was separated from her husband. Carrie Hartman had all the appearances outwardly, though, of being a respectable citizen. He had served as a reserve police officer, had been, you know, at one time given a badge and a gun, but he had two prior marriages that both involved significant instances of domestic violence. And then within about a year and a half of Cherie disappearing, he became a suspect and ultimately was convicted in a serial rape investigation where he had been breaking into women's homes or sneaking into women's homes at night, threatening to kill their children if they didn't comply with his demands, while he would then go ahead and sexually assault them. So for the investigators looking at Cherie's disappearance, you have these two high probability suspects. When Carrie Hartman is arrested in the rape investigation, witnesses start coming forward who were not, you know, they didn't feel safe to tell their stories before. And those include two women who had lived above Carrie Hartman at the time that Sheree Warren disappeared who said they believed on the night that Sheree disappeared that Sheree was at his apartment and that they had a fight. They heard a loud argument and then a thump and all going quiet. And Carrie Hartman, to this day, in my personal opinion, has not accounted for where he was and what he was doing the night that Sheree disappeared.
Well, there's a lot there, Dave.
Yeah. There's so much. Wow.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, and so, like, there's a lot of behavior for Laura and I to interpret here. And the first is these phone calls, these sexualized phone calls, these dirty calls, or whatever you want to call them. Those are what we would call, we used to call nuisance offenses, but they're also offenses that introduce offenders into a pattern of behavior that typically escalates. And so they're not just a nuisance. They're threshold offenses. And I think, Laura, you usually call it something else.
I certainly wouldn't call them nuisance because when you get them, they are terrifying. Yeah. And, you know, just to say that Heidi, who you talk with, you know, although she plays it down the whole way through the conversation, she's clearly fearful. Her mouth goes dry. All the indicators of fear and trauma were there. And so when police and others put these into the box of nuisance, no woman who receives these calls would ever describe it as that. But yeah, they're like precursor. And right. We normally see them on a continuum that we never know if someone's acting at the time, do we, Jim? But normally we know, particularly with stalkers, that they will start these behaviors. And the preparation, the being in those moments which they live for, they want more and more. And that's when we start to see up and close and personal behavior, because it's no longer enough just to be on the phone. So we do call them precursor behaviors, and that violence and abuse never happens in a vacuum. But the problem and the challenge for law enforcement is joining it all together, that these behaviors are linked. You've got 50 phone calls and some women don't report them because they think, oh, well, the police are busy and what are they going to do? They're going to say it's a nuisance. And therefore you miss this pattern. You miss the joining it all together, don't you, Jim? But for us, in terms of the behavioral profiling, these are absolutely really what important. We want to hear about.
Right. So what does it do? He's obviously causing these women fear, as Laura pointed out. He's connecting fear with sex because he turns the conversation sexual. He's most likely masturbating either during the calls or after the calls, thinking about it. And that is a fantasy component where he reinforces that violent connection to sex by masturbating, reinforces that arousal pattern. And what does that make him want to do? Do it more and more and live out these fantasies. And so when you say somebody started like that and then later he's convicted of rapes, that's completely unsurprising to me. It is a pattern of behavior. And then when you also think, well, maybe some of those rapes were reported, then that teaches an offender, I got to get rid of that person who could rat me out. And especially if that offender happens to be someone who's involved with law enforcement, who's a wannabe, who volunteers, you know, as a police officer, reserve police officer. We call it volunteer police officers in other departments, but basically he's a reserve officer. He's not really a police officer, but he gets a badge and a gun and he gets to work when they need extra people. And it gives him that imprimatur of authority, which he needs, because when he does the rapes, when we do connect him to rapes, we find out that he's a power reassurance rapist, which fits completely with that kind of personality. So there are four types, actually, of rape typologies. And one is power reassurance. And then there's power assertive, anger retaliatory, and anger excitation. So I'll go through the others and then land on power reassurance. So the worst, the most violent, is anger excitation. And these are sexual sadists. These people are sexually aroused by causing fear and suffering in someone else. They don't necessarily even have to have traditional sexual acts. They get off on causing the fear and suffering, the pain and suffering. So this is someone who wants to feel their pain and he wants them to show fear and suffering. That gets him off. The next type is anger retaliatory. And this is someone who wants to punish the women that he's raping. He has anger about women. He feels he's not being treated properly, and he is going to punish you. That's what his intent is with the rape. Control and punish. And then there's the power assertive. And this is someone who's trying to prove that he's a real man. He's a tough guy. And this is how he's going to do it. And it's an order of magnitude less in terms of the amount of violence they usually use during the rapes. But the power reassurance is a different animal. It's someone who's questioning his own manhood, who doesn't at all feel like he's a real man. So in his fantasies, he's able to go out with all these women. He sees these women. He wants to have sex with them. He wants them to be in a relationship with him. He doesn't feel he can do that. So instead, he threatens them. Usually, if he has a weapon, he only uses it to threaten them or their kids, as in this case. But rarely will he ever use it in the course of the rape because he's rationalizing in his brain, I'm not hurting them. This is actually a date.
They want it.
Yeah, but he'll say things like, was it good for you? And you need to lock your windows on the second floor because it's too easy to get in here. You know, you need to get a dog. These are things that actual power reassurance rapists have said to their victims, to victims they rape. They're not their victims, victims that they rape, that he is putting himself in a position where he feels like he can do this because this is not force. And I know that many times Carrie has said, I never physically forced any woman to do anything. All his denials year after year, decade after decade, were that he never physically forced women. And that is such a connection with power reassurance rapists. And so that type of personality we can see, right, Laura? From he probably started with these calls and peeping and following women and targeting them, and then, you know, then putting them in a situation where they were a little spooked, but he didn't do anything yet. And then when he got the confidence, he went in and raped them. And I think there's a whole situation that you describe about the window in the bottom of the pool where he takes a woman down there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he puts her in this situation and she kind of realizes a little late that, oh my God, he has gotten me into this situation. But fortunately, he didn't do anything violent to her at that point, but he did scare her.
Yes.
And I think that was important to him. And I think it was a step in the process.
I think looking at that, you summed it up so well, better than I ever could. The arc of his behavior becomes a major part of what we talk about in Cold Season 3, because as we get into the later part of the season, when we get to hear this man in his own words describe his accountability or lack thereof, right? There's this progression. Yes, yeah. Where he denies everything and then, okay, well, I'll admit to the one I was convicted of. And then, okay, well, I'll admit to whatever you specifically ask me about, but I won't volunteer anything until, you know, supposedly he gets to a full confession. But what we can say, having followed that after all these years, is, you know, he made thousands and thousands of these types of calls. I'm aware of contacts he made with people who, you know, reported, but their cases were never followed through the criminal justice system. He didn't disclose to those when he was, you know, supposedly giving full confession of everything that he had done. So behaviorally tearing into that and looking at, okay, what is there an inflection point in this story where this all could have been stopped? I strongly think there is. And it's right at the start of episode one of season three of Cold, where we hear him do this for supposedly the first time.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the typologies are very useful to understand, but I will, you know, Groff's typologies, which we all studied, but I will say that every rape case I've worked on power and control is what motivates them. And power and control is really important to understand because often people talk about sexual gratification, and that's not what they're seeking here. So as Jim described, looking, you know, at the swimming pool situation where he takes her to this area. I mean, why in the hell did they even have this viewing area where you can view people under the water is creepy as hell to me, I have to say, right? And I hate to say it, but some dude probably designed that, right? You're not going to see a woman designing this creepy kind of you can look at people under the water type thing. But he enjoyed putting her in that fear, and he connects that fear and it's not sex to him, but with the power. And that's everything that he's motivated by. Why does he want the gun and the badge? For power. Why does he link in with, you know, people in the media? Power. Why has he got mates who also are in the police? Well, the power and the level of manipulation. But the volume of what he was doing and, you know, how prolific, and you just said it, Dave, there were so many opportunities for prevention here. And that also is what makes me so angry with cases, because we go back to what we were talking about for season one, season two. Where are the intervention and prevention points? And with the perpetrators, you'll always have them downplay what they did. And sometimes the victims might minimize too, but often law enforcement also minimize it and play it down, and the slap on the wrist, rather than dad saying, well, what's he done this time? You know, people around know that he's a problem. So why aren't you gathering that information and intelligence? Because that call, we know that he did other things before it, and he was probably doing many more as a teenager. And so it's making sure that we understand that men don't just rape in their third, fourth decade of life. They've been doing things prior to that. And the power and control dynamic in their intimate relationships with women, I've always seen coercive control. And the women don't describe it like that. But then when you hear the men, you interview them, they say things just as he did. I wasn't a violent person. But you've got all these accounts from women about his violence. Oh, well, okay, well, I hit them. If he's pushed to it, then because there's something in it for him, the parole, then he might admit to it. But I wasn't sexually violent. So we go back to Jim's point, because to them, unless they're holding them down or they're being physically violent, then the women are enjoying it. And it is just a normal interaction. And for the women, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you don't fight back, well, did you scream? What did you do to... Well, I was frozen. So you didn't tell him you didn't want it? Because he says it's consensual. And so you get into this whole muddying the waters. And the Carrie story is no different from many others, that he's a good talker. He knows which buttons to press. He's learned law enforcement and the job of law enforcement. And he's got the ability to manipulate. And I'm not going to call him clever. He's devious. And Jim and I both know how devious sex offenders are. And they're devious in every aspect of their life, and they don't get given enough understanding. They go on these sex offender therapy treatment programs where most of them just reenact their fantasies out over and over again. They say what they need to say to get out. And there might be someone who's smart, and you spoke to a couple of officers who's smart enough to say, well, let's press him on this case, that case. Let's get 10 steps ahead of him and not just believe what he's saying to get out. Someone clearly thought that because he served 32 years, but right. a real danger to women. And he probably should never have been released, quite frankly.
Well, I agree completely with that. The amount of information that you have in these 10 episodes about this case is staggering. It's amazing. And you have laid out information that, like, as I said earlier, what we do is we look at behavior. We're not so focused on the words that come out of their mouths. Like, for year after year after year, he just denied, denied, denied whenever he came to the parole board. But eventually, he started parroting back what he learned in his therapy sessions. And what this did, it actually revealed something about him. Because none of the words that came out of his mouth about how he's a changed man and how you're sick and how he was involved in pornography then. This is exactly what Bundy said to the Christian people who came to try to save him in the last 2 weeks of his life. But then he spent the last 2 weeks with my old boss, Bill Hagmeier, and he laughed at how he manipulated the Christian people by saying that it was all pornography. It was bullshit. It was a plan. Pornography didn't drive him to do it. He used pornography to help reinforce these very violent sexual fantasies that he loved. that he embraced. And that's exactly what Carrie did, I believe. But when he did say the right words, and I'm putting that in air quotes, to the parole board, it was all about him. None of it was about how, the pain and suffering that I caused. I'm so sorry. I realize now it was about him and how he was lost, how he was making bad decisions. None of that shows actual empathy. This guy is still locked in his psychopathic, non-empathetic, self-indulgent sex fantasies. That's what he's still locked in. And that's why I still feel he's dangerous.
And I'll just point out, Jim, from my perspective, the important thing here is that this all overshadows the disappearance of Sheree Warren, right? Carrie is potentially one of two named suspects who had motive and opportunity to do something to Sheree. And over the past 30 plus years, there has been a failure to account for his whereabouts, his potential role on the night that she disappeared. And for him to be in our community, or, you know, surrounding the victims that are still there as well from all those years ago, is, I think, something that the public needs to be aware of. And that is a driving force behind why we chose to tell Sheree Warren's story in Cold Season 3.
Well, and I'm great. Glad that you did choose to do it. And I know we're going to talk to you some more because we can't do it justice, your incredible investigation. And how long did it take, by the way, Sheree Warren's? It's 10 episodes, but how long did it take for you to investigate and produce this?
We've been working at KSL Podcasts on this season for probably, I would say, 2 years.
Wow.
Wow, it's a long time, but which, you know, our listeners, you really must listen to it for yourselves because you'll hear so many parts of the behavior that we're talking to, but we still have more to discuss as well. So I still have some questions that I would love to ask you. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
After hearing our episode today, you've got to listen to Cold Season 3. Cold Season 3 premieres on February 20th, but you can binge early and ad-free right now on Amazon Music or Wondery Plus. If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.